The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome, friends, to a very, very special interview with let me start it with a personal note. I had the undeserved distinction to serve in the White House as quote unquote strategist to the president, which looks lovely on my commissioning document now at home, signed by President Trump. But it's a little bit embarrassing because as an addict of matters national security and strategy, it is my determination that there are a handful of people who deserve to be called strategists alive today. They include people like Victor Davis Hanson. They include somebody who we lost recently, sadly, Colin Gray. They include individuals like Marty van Krefeld. And one of the few individuals who is in that category is our guest today. He is Professor Ed Lutwak, Szépjó napot neked, a fellow individual of Hungarian extraction as myself, who visited us several times in the White House. If you're unfamiliar with the good professor, shame on you. You need to look into this man's works. He has an incredible career, a PhD. He went to Johns Hopkins, London School of Economics, was a teacher, a professor, University of Bath, Georgetown University. He has served as a consultant to too many organizations, government agencies to enumerate. I'll just mention the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, State Department, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, author of more than 20 books. The one that I think made him infamous at the get-go was Coup d'État in 1968, but also, very important, the grand strategy of the Roman Empire from the first century AD to the third, Strategy, the Logic of War and Peace, and then the Rise of China versus the Logic of Strategy. Professor Lutwak, welcome to our studio.
Thank you.
Let me start with a personal anecdote. When you launched one of your recent books, The Grand Strategy of the Byzantine Empire, you came and gave a speech at National Defense University at the beautiful War College there at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C. At the time, I was on the faculty of National Defense University, and I was in the audience. And you gave a sterling, fascinating speech about this peculiar thing, the Byzantine Empire, which, if I remember well, you said should have lasted about 8 months if you looked at its strengths, the correlation of forces, but lasted for 8 centuries. And your book was an explication of how on earth they did that. In the Q&A period, I got to ask the first question. I don't know if you recall, but I said, Professor Lutwak, what is your comment to those who say that the United States, for all its strength, for its might economically, has become astrategic, unstrategic since the end of the Cold War? And your response was, as far as I'm concerned, classic Lutwak. You said, what is the point of being a superpower if you can't be stupid? That was 11 years ago. How are we doing right now? How is what François Eisberg has called the world's only hyperpower? How are we doing now in terms of our strategic capabilities?
Well, if you carefully avert your eyes from what's going on inside the United States, outside the United States, the American position is very strong and getting stronger. And the reason is that the Russian antagonist is weakened because Putin's power system, which keeps him very solidly in control of the Kremlin, happens to strangle the economy. If you want to start a business in Russia, you have to start paying off before you can make profits. And this doesn't work. So Russia is sinking economically. At the present moment, by that very rough, crude, and measure of gross domestic product, it's about the level of Italy.
A country with 11 time zones.
11 time zones.
Has the GDP of Italy with one time zone.
Correct.
Right.
What the Russians haven't lost is their ability to generate a great deal of power from very little economic capacity. They're very good at that. Putin strangles the economy because he's the head of a corrupt system, a hierarchy of bribe-taking. But he is very Russian in his ability to use what he has very effectively. So they have the GDP of Italy, but 10 times the power of Italy. However, they are confined. And the other was the growing antagonist, China. The fat man in the elevator who's getting fatter and fatter, squeezing everybody else against the walls. Even if he was smiling and benign, people would have to push back. As it happens, he's angry because, as you know, power within China went from a group of people, Politburo, with Mr. Hu Jintao, who was the primus inter pares, the first among equals, to a sort of corporal, a stupid corporal, Xi Jinping, whose solution for everything is to frog march people. Everybody in the parade ground, march here, march there, and if they are resistant, to lock them up. So what has it done is that he has endowed the United States with a great maritime alliance. Japan, India, Vietnam, which is small and courageous and tough, and Australia, which has demonstrated great strategic foresight, because in that, indeed, it was the first country back in the ancient days of 2008 when everybody turned to China to help them with economic crisis. Back in 2009, they issued a white paper, a very simple white paper, saying that the Chinese are extremely... they're structured for aggression, and if the countries around China don't get together, they'll be dominated by China. That was the famous white paper. At that point, the Japanese prime minister was a neutralist. The Indian prime minister was somebody who said, I don't care if they cross the border, I'm focusing on the economy. And the United States, Obama, was focusing on the economic crisis. And then, when the economic crisis passed, he had the Susan Rice advice. You know, Susan Rice said she can handle China. You know, China is malleable, it's shapeable.
Along with Biden, no? Biden.
Biden was the vice president for Obama until the last 6 months. Then, when Xi Jinping came to Beijing, he realized that he had been very cruelly treated, but he never came out in public and said, I made a horrible mistake in following Susan Rice. And the whole view that China was shapeable. She kept saying she could shape it, you know, resisting countermeasures, resisting patrols in the South China Sea, telling Admiral Harris out in Honolulu not to do anything because she could shape China. You know, I asked her, is it a very small country like Kiribati or Vanuatu? Does it have no culture to speak of? So do you just give them a check, you know? Anyway.
There's hubris and then there's Susan Rice.
Correct.
All right.
Hearing her name as a possible vice president, makes strong men weep if that happens.
We have to discuss your most recent book, The Rise of China versus the Logic of Strategy. But let me force you on this issue. In the last 3.5 years, give us your estimation of how America's standing in the world has been changed, and how you rate my old boss, President Trump.
Well, until the virus, I was a traveling man because all this academic stuff you mentioned has been 10% of my life. 90% is I'm a consultant and contractor, and I do security stuff that keeps me young. You know, you have to run around, sometimes not with bare hands. So... if you went to Japan, to Korea, to Taiwan, and indeed to China, and you said, what do you think about Trump? When Trump arrived, you know, they would all say, I fell to my knees, and I thanked my deity, whatever that was, Karl Marx or Buddha or whatever, because they were all our friends, allies, and indeed neutrals in Asia were terrified of Obama because the Chinese seized coral reefs, shoals, little rocks, turned them into big bases, and the United States said nothing. Nothing. Not even on environmental grounds.
Well, they said there was a pivot to Asia, but there was no substance.
All right. So long as Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, there was a pivot to Asia. She did start some interesting things like the Lower Mekong Initiative, which is all the countries on the Mekong except China, to get them together. She tried something when she was. But as soon as Clinton left the State Department, it all fell apart. And therefore, the fantastic spectacle. China goes, takes all these islets and rocks that don't belong to China at all, 1,000 miles from China, right in front of our Philippines, our treaty ally Philippines, right in front of Indonesia, and say, this is ours. They start building huge bases, and the United States does nothing, says nothing, doesn't react. This was very sinister development. It caused changes, some of which were good changes. For example, the neutralism in Tokyo got knocked right out. Abe comes back and says, the Americans have dropped the ball. We have to do more. We're more independent. That happened. Second thing that happened is that in India itself, Modi came to power. His predecessor said, I don't care who crosses the border. I focus on the economy. I mean, what goes on out in the Himalayas, you know, it's so far from Delhi. Hard to get there. The roads are bad. He kept them bad. So things changed. Now, if you went to Asia, Trump got and still today says this is a serious guy. He focuses on China. He has reinforced the military. He's a big guy. If you go to Europe, you have a split thing. Trump has fanatical supporters and devoted supporters and serious supporters in a proportion of 30-40% of the center-right all over Europe. Evidently, center-right leader like Boris Johnson is comfortable with Trump, but wouldn't be comfortable with any Democrat. And you have people who have an understanding that either it's a tough America or it's not America. The Obama, you know, global warming, and not challenging anybody, America didn't please those Europeans. But the 51% who are highly bureaucratized, they of course welcome the Democratic Party winning in America because they see the Democratic Party copying European social democracy, putting everybody, you know, huge social programs, increasing welfare. The message is, we look after you from cradle to grave, and you just toot along and vote for us and so on. The old social democracy, whose model was always Sweden.
Yes.
Except that the Swedes totally turned their backs to it.
Right.
And now laugh every time the Swedes see people invoking Sweden, like Sanders, you know, saying, oh, I'm not a communist. I want it like Sweden. Everybody in Sweden views the social democratic generation as a horror show of bureaucrats deciding everything. So therefore, you know, that's a mixed thing.
Yeah, I think the Danish prime minister actually called out people like Bernie Sanders, who said, no, we are not a socialist state. We are a market democracy. So he actually said that publicly.
Right.
While we're on this issue, how would you fit the Trump presidency, the Trump foreign policy, and any taxonomy? We have the election slogans of Make America Great Again. We have America First. If you had to give it a slightly more academic label, what are we talking about in the last 3.5 years?
Well,
is it peace through strength like Reagan?
Well, first, there was the geopolitics. And I have to admire, in a sinister way, admire the discipline, the enormous discipline of all the Democrats on absolutely refusing to hear Trump's words saying, I want to focus against China.
Yeah.
Nixon focused against the Soviet Union and embraced China and kissed Mao, even though Mao never used the toothpaste. sacrificed himself, in effect, embracing China to face Russia. And Trump said, I want to go easy on Russia, tolerate all their misbehavior, because I want to focus on China and I want to drive them to support China. The Democrats steadfastly, with wonderful discipline, refused to acknowledge these geopolitics and kept saying that Trump is sympathetic to Russia because he's bribed or blackmailed, and systematically refused to see it, even though the Nixon goes to China, I go to Moscow, is geopolitics 101. They totally refused to acknowledge it, neither as politicians or the Washington Post or anybody else.
Can I ask?
This shows that there is a Bolshevik discipline there.
So this is the question for me. Is that a function of discipline, or is it a function of truly being such a hostage to your ideology?
No, I think that they are conscious of the fact.
Conscious.
That Trump had this strong argument.
Right.
Nixon goes to China to oppose the Soviet Union and embraces China. This is the Chow of Mao, mass murdering Mao.
Right.
This is not a China where nobody had any freedom at all. Right. I mean, whatever you can say about Xi Jinping, and I have a lot to say against him, life in China today is still 1,000 times better than it was when Kissinger and Nixon embraced China. Why did they do that? Remember, it's 1972.
Context.
The United States is sliding in Vietnam. Congress won't give a penny to build the armed forces. Ships in the Pacific break down, and Russians are surging. Because they made a huge overinvestment, military overinvestment. It would destroy their economy. In the meantime, they were surging with superiority in ballistic missiles and everything you name. In this context, the United States goes to China, embraces China, and now acquires a big ally because it drives the Russians, to send half their army on the Chinese border. Huge success. So when Trump started signaling that he wants to focus on China. In other words, like Trump, Obama in the last 3 months, once he realized the error of his ways, terrible mistake, China is not going democratic, it's going the other way, and it's expanding militarily, and it's grabbing territory, focused on that, they realized it was a powerful argument, so they kept talking about blackmail, bribery, stories about non-existent trips to Moscow with non-existent prostitutes and non-existent video, everything. Great discipline. Not one of them broke ranks. They all knew it was a lie. So to me, this is Bolshevik discipline.
In the beginning of our discussion, you said our performance internationally, geopolitically, has been very impressive under President Trump, but you said not so much domestically. Let's talk about what's happened in the last few weeks inside the United States. Several people have couched the current political environment, not just here, but in Western civilization in general, as a duel of new ideologies. It's two populisms. It's an old type of socialist populism, the Bernie type of populism, the Corbyn populism of Labour, as was, vice the Modi, Trump, the Brexit version of populism. Is that what is that the core factor behind the conflict inside the United States, or is it something deeper?
Well, I wasn't born in America. You were, Sam, right?
I was not.
I know you were not.
I was born in England.
So we're two foreigners talking about the United States. My perspective is that the American Revolution started in 1776. And it started because, as you know, they wanted to be rid of the rule by George III, by the monarchy. And the American Revolution, since 1776, occasionally takes a nap, but it's still a revolutionary country. It's still a country where people value change much more than stability. All over the world, normal people, non-revolutionary people, like stability. They say, oh, this is my old house. I was born here. My grandfather was born here. My grandchildren will be born here. this is what I want. Americans say, oh, well, it was in Milwaukee. I couldn't get a job in Texas. They were hiring, bang, put everything, sold
That's
everything.
True.
Americans are revolutionaries in their personal life, and America is a revolutionary society, occasionally takes a nap. And occasionally, revolutionary society goes to war, focuses on destroying the enemy, and stops the domestic revolution. But otherwise, it's revolutionary. Trump's 2016 campaign was a revolutionary campaign because he took every existing axiomatic statement, you know, and overturned it and said, no, we can do much better by just junking it. Ronald Reagan, people forget, was the subject of much deeper opprobrium than Trump. Ronald Reagan, a week before the election, front page Washington Post, a man called Averell Harriman, who had been ambassador everywhere, who was Roosevelt's big man, who was everybody's big man, who lived in a huge mansion in Georgetown, and he was the social king of Washington, said if Ronald Reagan is elected president, there will be nuclear war. And nevertheless, Americans did the revolutionary thing, and they voted for Ronald Reagan, who, upon becoming president, said, what's the whole basis of American foreign policy? Answer, coexistence. There is a Soviet Union, there is us, we have nuclear weapons, we don't want nuclear war. Therefore, coexistence. Therefore, he's president, and I was there with him. I was a member of the foreign policy, so-called interim advisory board, was a bunch of guys around Reagan when the State Department arrives and says, well, Mr. President, Mr. Future President, it was a week before, once you installed in the White House, we will start working towards our meeting with the Russian foreign minister to arrange the summit meeting with the Secretary General Brezhnev in Moscow. And Trump said, oh, boys, you can relax. You don't have to meet the foreign minister because I'm not going to meet Brezhnev. I don't want to meet them. And they all said, but this is the basis. Summit meetings are the pillars of coexistence, which is the basis of our whole foreign policy. And all our allies agree. Reagan said, I don't want it. We will exist and we will prosper. The Soviet Union must disappear. The peoples of the Soviet Union, starting with the Russians, have to be free. And everybody was horrified. When word got around town, they thought that Reagan had campaigned by using this, stuff. But in fact, once he's president, he'll fall into line and do coexistence. When he refused to do it, they didn't say that he was a bad guy like Trump, rude like Trump, nasty. No, they said he's going to destroy the world because he's going to cause nuclear war. And what happened is that he persisted and persisted, and in the end, it wasn't Reagan that fell, but something else, the Soviet Union. And this is revolutionary politics today, is a different direction, but it's still revolutionary.
But they never called him an asset of the Kremlin, like the media, yes. The Democrats right. have been doing for years with Donald Trump, the president.
Yeah, exactly. This fabrication, and I'm sorry to say that for the second time in my lifetime, the FBI, that is employees of the FBI, not today's FBI, under today's director, but the employees of the FBI, under this
Obama.
Fellow
right.
Comey, whatever his name was,
yep.
That they conspired to do it. It was never credible, but it was part of this propaganda line that if Trump is pro-Russian, it cannot be because of geopolitics 101 that you don't do China and Russia at the same time. No, it had to be because he's an agent or something. The fact that this was given credibility, I think for a long while, I think now they all realize that it was a lie. They concocted it, they cooked it, they spread it. But, you know, it was quite a remarkable spectacle.
Let me ask you what you would describe all of that as, because the book that launched your stellar career was Coup d'etat.
Yes.
What would you call Operation Crossfire Hurricane and the surveillance of the presidential campaign? What is the best word to describe it? Because some have called it a soft coup.
Yeah, well, look, the coup d'etat is a group of individuals who control some perhaps small but critical part of the state machine who use it to take over control of the state. Typically, some colonel who commands a brigade,
yep.
but it happens to be the brigade in the capital city,
right.
drives up to the presidential palace, captures the president, who gets killed while attempting to flee, of course, and then goes on the radio and says, I've taken control. That's it. It's a new government and so on. Coup d'etat. Small part. Perhaps the army has many brigades. This is just one brigade. And he persuades, three or four battalion commanders and some company commanders, voila, 10 people take over the state. In this case, it was a group of individuals whose names, of course, are known. They were intercepted. They were published. And who decided that Trump should not win the election. And that if he did win the election, that they would remove Trump by whatever they say. Yeah. Don't worry, somebody said to somebody, FBI employee says to another, don't worry, we will stop him.
Yeah.
Okay, out of this came the entire thing, and then there was Trump's huge mistake. Trump's huge mistake was that he talked with Comey, the head of FBI, in fact, invited him to dinner, tried to reason with him. Whereas what he should have done...
You fire him straight off.
It should have been to do two things. First, to call in the Democratic leaders and say, I'm forced to fire Comey because he twice interrupted the election by finding supposed problems with Hillary's server. Right. Twice right. interrupted the election. Right. He tried to put himself... We're having an election in America... And the head of the FBI tried to put himself in control of the election because once he said that he found stuff on Hillary's computer, the election stopped. So Mr. Comey, head of the FBI, sees this coup d'etat right there, seizing control of the electoral process. So Trump had been smart, and I'll say that. He would have called in the majority leader, the Democrats, whoever it was, minority leaders, and a few other people at the White House, maybe people from the Supreme Court, they had the Supreme Court, and so on, and said, look, Mr. Comey interrupted the election. Mr. Comey attempted to make himself the center of the election. This damaged my opponent, Hillary Clinton, and I'm glad of it because I'm president. But now, as president, I want to fire him. And I don't want to do it now because otherwise his minions inside the FBI, whose names we don't know, will start spreading rumors about me. So I want us to fire him. That would have turned things the other
way.
Very
smart.
Yes, yeah. But I want to tell you that I made a futile attempt to reach the president at the time to convey this very message that he should have said something like, we have the separation of powers in this country, and there is one problem, there is one piece that's not separated. It's called the FBI. And I don't like the fact that the president's named the head of the FBI. It should be named by a bipartisan commission or the Supreme Court or somebody else. And that is what I tried to reach and pass. At that time, I had no access.
So what would you have called what the Democrats did? A subversive operation?
No,
sedition?
No. This was a coup d'etat.
Really?
In a classic definition of using a small part of the state involving a handful of people in order to overthrow, in this case, a government, or rather, the election result,
yeah.
by concocting evidence against Trump. And that's why the FBI violated all its professional standards by reaching out and getting this dossier put together by a
MI6,
former right. British intelligence operative who put its dossier together, the fellow did, to make some money.
Yeah.
For the Clinton campaign as adversarial research and so on. It was a sleazy little thing, but nothing illegal, by the way, all legal. And the FBI goes and dignifies it and treats it as if it were a source.
But then it would later result in criminality when that dossier was used as the justification for FISA warrants.
Correct.
Without it being disclosed of having been paid for
opposition
research.
Yeah, for interception
yes,
warrants.
For surveillance.
FISA is the permission
secret
to
interception.
Intercept and do other stuff.
Right.
Everything follows from that.
Right.
Everything followed from that. But, as I say, this is the moment when Trump, having won the presidency, having discovered what was going on with Comey, having taken the measure of the man, invites him to dinner.
Yeah.
That was a huge mistake because, of course, Comey naturally took notes, which everybody in the Washington Post immediately accepted as gospel, right. saying that, you know, Trump did this and did that. And they listen his notes, not recordings, not the tape,
no.
notes.
And the allegation of the loyalty demand. Yes, exactly. We remember. Yeah,
I mean, all kinds of stuff happened. But as I say, Trump's mistake was an early mistake, an irreparable mistake. As it turns out.
You've described, I love this description or this distinction of America and other nations, that we are a revolutionary nation, and sometimes we take a nap, we fall asleep. So what's happening right now? Who are the revolutionaries? Are the revolutionaries Black Lives Matter and Antifa? Discuss, Professor, if you would, what we are witnessing in the last 4 or 5 weeks since the George Floyd killing.
This is... once again, the black population is being exploited by whites. And the whites in question is the university-generated ideology, which is called intersectional. Intersectional ideology. And it's a very clever ideology. People who refuse gender definitions. That is, homosexuals, lesbians, and then all these subcategories.
The transgender.
They've invented this transgender
right.
and stuff.
Right, right.
They are, in nature, of course, a minority. In order for them to get power, they have to make a federation. They have to make an alliance. So they aligned themselves with parts of the old extreme left, which is the Sanders left. Not Sanders, but the left part of Sanders, which believes in basically not socialism at all, but Bolshevik-type communism, because their focus on the wealth tax and the fact that their tricky way of saying, don't worry about it, Mr. and Mrs. American, because we're only going to apply for people who have more than $10 zillion. Of course, the moment you enact the wealth tax, you discover that the few billionaires don't actually yield a lot, because most wealth in America is not in the hands of billionaires. It's in the hands of people who have very much less than a billion. And therefore, the wealth tax becomes a way for these hard socialists to transfer the money. Blasio, the mayor of New York, said publicly, there's plenty of money in this country. It's in the wrong hands.
Yes.
And we need to fix that.
Yeah.
When he said that, the rich people of New York should have gone to the appropriate legal state body to call for his impeachment and removal or revocation, whatever it was. Because what he said was the following. He said, plenty of money in this country. It's in the wrong hands. We need to fix that. In other words, I'm a Democratic politician. Most people in New York City are not billionaires. They are going to give me the power once I become president. He said that when running for the White House. Then this Bolshevik attitude, it was conscious because, you know, Blasio was in Nicaragua with the Sandinistas. He's a hardline Marxist, Leninist, communist. They don't exist in Russia anymore, but there he is, the mayor of New York. When he said that, all the rich people in New York continued in their poor sin indifference. You know, poor sin.
Or moved to Connecticut. Pig-like.
No, they had the manger eating. So, who cares? Who cares? The sexual guys make by themselves are too few. The multigender people are too few. So they make an alliance with the hard Bolshevik left. And they also too few. So what do? They say, oh, we're going to enlist people of color. So they go to the Indians, the Indians in America, from India. And the Indians say, no, thank you, sir. We're doing very well in America. We don't want it to be any different. We don't want Bolshevism. We don't want Indians to shut up and go away. They go to the Asian Americans who tell them, go away, the Chinese, the Koreans or some. And then, of course, they go to the Hispanics, and they find that many Hispanics are hardworking people who want to rise in the world. They also say, no. Hence, once again, they enslave the blacks. They go and go to the plantation, go to the blacks, and now somebody invents Black Lives Matter. It doesn't work at first, but then with the Floyd thing, the intersectionals do it. Now comes the responsibility of the owners of the New York Times, who appoint, who overthrow the reasonable, serious journalist editor, put intersectionals in charge. They mobilized the New York Times. They mobilized the Washington Post, the Amazon Post, as I call it. Gets, and suddenly, these organs of the American establishment, the voices of the American establishment, have changed, and they become the intersectional voice. And here is this ideology successfully builds a strong coalition by starting with a few sexual, you know, for a small percentage of sexual people. Then you put in the Bolsheviks or a few percent. Now you enlist the blacks, and the blacks hit the streets. When they hit the streets, you have defund the police to prevent the streets to be controlled. So this is clever. This is something like Lenin and the Leninists and Bolsheviks, who were a very tiny minority. They used the term Bolshevik, which means, of course, majority.
Large, but the
they called themselves you know, in fact, they were a minority intersectional.
Propaganda from the beginning.
They were intersectionals.
Right.
And their first government was an intersectional government because they joined the Bundists and the Mensheviks and the left social revolutionaries who were intellectuals in Petersburg. This is what they're trying to do is a forcible revolution. They still cannot be the majority. By far, they cannot, but they seize the media. The behavior of the New York Times, the owners of the New York Times, the owners of the Washington Post, allowing their media to be captured by these ideologues is a crime.
What is the strategic objective? Is this about the election in 4 months' time, or are the people who are the key motors behind this, is it truly an anarchistic end state?
Oh, no. There's no anarchy involved here.
No, so it is political power.
No, this is transfer of power. Now, Biden is a serious, very seasoned, moderate politician. Biden is not who they wanted. They wanted to have at least Sanders.
Yes.
But they're stuck with Biden. So what do? They mount an intersectional. Remember, the intersectional campaign that he has to have a female and black vice president.
Right.
And who then is the female vice president? The one that pops out is Kamala Harris. Suddenly, no, we don't want Kamala Harris because back when she was young, she was a prosecutor and she arrested Joe Bloggs and put him in prison. Why? Because she's not part of the intersectional thing. So this is an attempt to seize control of American society using devices like the Green New Deal. Why would this Cortez woman in New York and so on, why would she embrace the suddenly climate change, Green New Deal? She's lived in a city all her life. She hasn't seen a tree. She doesn't grasp nature. She doesn't care.
She doesn't understand plants.
It's intersectional ideology, which is you use the Green New Deal to disestablish, to seize control of the American economy. Because if you look at that document, and you'll see that as a householder, if you don't insulate your house to the standard, they'll come and do it for you, and they'll acquire ownership of half of your house, whatever it is, or the 10%, depends. Then if you're a corporation and you don't fall into line, the federal government will seize you or control you. In other words, this is actually a revolutionary attempt for a small minority of people to seize control of American society as a whole. And the Biden winning the White House under Biden would be just as an instrument, because the real purpose is to have Biden come in with the vice president, and then he would kick the bucket, the vice president takes over, and the vice president is either one of them or one black person that they're going to manipulate. Because for the intersectionals, the blacks are strictly to be plantation blacks. They have to do what they're told. They have to create the big disorder in Minneapolis. But if you remember, the ones who went smashing the windows were all white,
white
guys, white college graduates covering their faces. So this is the intersectionals capturing the black problem, the angst, the problem of 20-30% of the black population. As you know, over the median income of black households in America is $58,000 a year. And nobody gave it to them. They get it by earning it. And this is the minority who don't work, who can't work, you know, the children of 15-year-old girls in Baltimore, et cetera, whose grandmothers were 15. And this little group are the plantation blacks, which the intersectionals are seized and put in front. They're the ones that they shove in front. But the video's coming out. When you see acts of violence, extreme violence, leadership, talking, attacking the police,
they're white,
telling the policemen, they're all white, or 90% white, or whatever they are. And, so this is another case of exploiting blacks.
Another instance of Democrats, white Democrats, exploiting black Americans. We're talking to Ed Lutwak, author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace, The Grand Strategy of the Byzantine Empire, Coup d'Etat, A Practical Handbook, and most recently, The Rise of China versus the Logic of Strategy. We will discuss China momentarily. You can actually follow the good professor. He is now on Twitter at E. Lutwak, L-U-T-T-W-A-K. Before we end our discussion by talking about China, I have to ask you, as somebody born in Eastern Europe, who's lived in Europe, who has served as an advisor to the Reagan administration, witnessed the fall of the Iron Curtain, you used the phrase Bolshevism again and again and again with regards to political actors in America. How is it, and I don't mean to be rhetorical here or to seem naive, my parents suffered under fascism and communism. My father was arrested by the secret police, tortured and imprisoned by the Hungarian secret police. How is it that the ideology that has failed in 40 countries of the world, that has resulted in the deaths of 100 million human beings, that doesn't even exist anymore in Russia, how is it that we have ostensibly successful political actors in America who follow this creed?
I think that there is an explanation. In 1972, when I arrived in the United States, I visited in 69 because Dean Acheson actually hired me to be like a briefcase carrier. Yes, Dean Acheson, a great sir. But I came, it was just a visit. 72, at that point in time, being a professor at Johns Hopkins University meant that you wore elegant clothes, you lived elegantly, and you had a beautiful house and everything else. What then happened between 1972 and the present is that administrative people, the deans so-called, took control of universities, awarded themselves million-dollar salaries, and university teachers were reduced to the proletariat. In other words, when I first came, I briefly considered the possibility of being a professor. I was offered professorship. I was thinking about it. I was very young, and it seemed like an honor, and the salary was very good. What happened is that they have been reduced to earning much less than plumbers. Much less. Not less, much less than plumbers.
And not only that.
They've been torn, and they look around. It's a society getting more and more prosperous, everybody getting prosperous.
Yep.
They become proletarians. They're very poorly paid. Moreover, these administrators who seize control, they, the deans of this, the dean of that.
Diversity.
You know, like the dean of admission at Harvard University,
right,
who earns much more than any stupid professor. And stuff. These guys, what happens is that they are becoming proletarian. They see everybody else. They turn, become resentful, envious, resentful.
So it's revenge?
Socialism of jealousy and the socialism of envy. The politics of envy become entrenched in American universities. So students come in, and the teacher says to the student, don't be a stupid idiot like your father who is a businessman. No, no, do something worthwhile. Go and work for a non-government organization. Go to Africa and teach African fishermen how to fish, you know, even though you never fished in your life, you know, NGO stuff. non-government organization. The teachers do lose their economic standing in society. They get driven down. They get driven below stairs. They become poor, and you see the phenomenon. You know, they go and teach wearing jeans and dungarees and so on, not three-piece suit with a little chain with a gold watch in the pocket. No, so they become proletarian, and as proletarians, they resent everybody else making money. They have most of them are teaching things, and of course, the administrative class has proliferated subjects in universities. You don't study mathematics or Latin or the engineering great books. You don't study engineering or that. No, what you study is 77 different varieties of sociology under the name of gender studies, queer studies,
diversity,
gender studies, diversity studies, black studies, brown studies, Indian studies, and then you come out with your parents having made sacrifices, or you borrowed money from the federal government that you're supposed to pay back. And this, of course, not paying back is the key democratic platform, is that you shouldn't pay it back. Then you study this, then you go into the economy and you try and get a job. And, of course, what you're qualified for is to clean the floor, except Salvadorian immigrants do it better. So, in other words, this is not invented out of nowhere. First, they have been reduced to be poor in an increasingly affluent society. America rises in the last 50 years, and they decline in the last 50 years. They go down and down, and they lose tenure. The administrators, they have tenure. You can never fire them. But they lose tenure, which is the right not to, and they're forced to go on the road every 3 or 4 years, desperately looking for teaching jobs. And these are people who would have developed into solid scholars with a commitment to society, honored people, and instead, they've been driven to be a revolutionary class. If you create a revolutionary class, you will get revolution.
So this is absolutely fascinating. I haven't heard this anywhere else. So in 1868, in 1917, it was the exploited workers in the factory that Marx was trying to liberate. And now, through various unconscious, perhaps unintended actions, it is the untenured professor who has become the working class revolutionary.
Right, except that they're the doers. Please remember, Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, Kalinin, none of them was a worker. They were all the equivalent of, with degrees in social studies.
Right. They were really bourgeoisie.
They were bourgeoisie with no useful skills.
Right.
Not one of them was a dentist.
And these people, that they are proto seed of a revolutionary class, are in the position to generate drones, thousands of drones who are their students.
Right.
And the resentment is the driving force.
So you degraded the university professors into people, poorly paid people with low standing. They therefore turned the students into left-wing agitators.
Yes.
And the parents who pay for it say nothing. And the trustees of Harvard University, when Harvard University suddenly fired the president, Larry Summers, of Harvard University on a false accusation that he offended some woman or other, or women, or so. The trustees didn't march down onto Harvard and say, not a penny more if you stop doing that. And instead, they allowed that their trustees were pig-like indifferent to what was going
but
on.
But not just trustees.
They funded.
The alumni.
Correct.
The alumni
keep giving money to universities that corrupt their children with outdated, absurd, left-wing ideologies, and when you call them on it, they say, no, we don't want Stalin, we want Sweden, okay? And then which is a lie, huge lie, as you know.
I've already, if you'll indulge me, I already have planned our second discussion. We have to dedicate a whole hour to
what do we do about these mills of drone production, leftist production? If you have ideas, what we will do with them, and perhaps the coronavirus, the Chinese virus, will help us given the financial instability of some of these educational institutions. But we have only a few minutes left. Let's talk about everybody. You must read this man's book. When I was teaching in the Defense Department, I said you have to read the classics. You have to read Sun Tzu, von Clausewitz. You have to read the late John Keegan. You have to read Martin van Kleefeld, Colin Gray, Victor Davis Hanson. And you must read this man's works. His recent interviews in The Economist, in The Wall Street Journal, but his classic works, especially The Grand Strategy of the Byzantine Empire, Coup d'Etat, and also let's discuss your most recent book, The Rise of China versus the Logic of Strategy. In the last few moments we have, first things first, what would you say are the greatest, or is the greatest fallacy or point of ignorance that the quote-unquote policy elite has with regards to China today?
Well, it's the belief that the Chinese have a strategic mind, that they're coherent, that the leadership of the Communist Party knows what it's doing. It's not. Because all the Chinese would have to do is to scrap their navy, stop threatening people, abandon the stupid and useless, indefensible bases they built in the South China Sea.
The atolls.
Yes. Yeah, right. And then they would offer to Asia what? Investment, their own huge market, tourism, and everything else, and they would dominate Asia.
So that would be the smart thing.
If they were disarmed, they would dominate Asia. Instead, what do? Instead of winning over Japan, they demand three uninhabited rocks, the Senkakus. Right. Instead of winning over India, they spill over the border to grab the Galwan Valley, which I've been to.
With baseball bats.
Right, yeah, with baseball. In other words, the belief that the Chinese know what they're doing in the realm of strategy is the fundamental error. And there is that unfortunate thing about Shunzi, that they spell Sun Tzu, which is not strategy at all. It's just a bag of tricks.
Yeah, bag of tricks.
Which is how you...
And often tactical, just
no,
super
no, no,
tactical.
No, it's all tricks. Right, right. And the Chinese do use tricks all the time. And the other thing they use is bribery. If you find a politician in Europe today, okay, who is not in power, like Orban, Prime Minister of Hungary, so, politician who supports the Chinese... He is on the payroll.
He's on the payroll.
Because the Chinese rightly believe that many politicians can be bought. For example, when the state of Italy makes concessions to the state of China, the state of China does not make concessions to Italy. Instead, it pays off two or three politicians, right, active or retired.
And they've done this in Australia. I mean, this is not, theory.
Right, but in Australia, being an Anglo-Saxon country with a functioning legal system and so on, they got caught.
They got caught.
And now it's all over for them.
Right.
In Italy, they don't get caught. You know, everybody knows that so-and-so got a lot of money from the Chinese, but no. So they're good at tricks. They're terrible at strategy. And they're mechanically repeating.
Right.
Kaiser Wilhelm, 1914. Germany had the best universities by far. It had the best advanced mechanical industry, electrical and everything, damn thing. And they threw it all away to have a navy to grab three islands in the Pacific. So strategic stupidity is the greatest crime of all.
So they're not some master strategists.
No.
In that case, what should be done about them? I remember I was in the White House when one of the first things we did, we reached out to Abe, we planned a trip to Asia, reassuring Vietnam and others in the Philippines, saying, look, we are back, America is back, we're not going to allow bullies like China to continue as they did under Obama. What is the next thing that has to be done? We had a trade war initiated prior to the coronavirus.
Right.
If we recover, what next?
Trade war is very important. And in fact, the Indians, as you know, are responding with the trade war. But the role of the United States should be to say, all of you frontline countries, Japan, Vietnam, India, Philippines, Indonesia, and those who choose to resist it, Malaysia, when they wake up, sometimes yes, and so on, All of you should know that if you get attacked, we will defend you. If we can support you, we will support you. But don't jump in front of them and you yourself do it, because then you won't get it right. You'll do too much, you'll do too little. And finally, there is the central fact, Taiwan. As it happens, even if Biden becomes president, there's still the Taiwan's Relations Act, which says the United States has a legal obligation to defend Taiwan. This was a hard obligation, partly because the Taiwanese military themselves continued to go for toys, you know, tanks, jet fighters, instead of adopting a diffused, popular, you know, national defense with missiles of all sorts, making themselves unconquerable. Today's technology allows that. Make themselves as unconquerable as other small countries, like the Finns or like the Israelis. You know, they don't need, no Americans have to fight to defend Taiwan. If the Taiwanese themselves do the necessary, but the United States is the guarantor. And, of course, it means that the Chinese cannot use nuclear threats on Taiwan. Surrender or we bomb you, kind of stuff. Which they couldn't do for 10 reasons, but including that. The United States has to be there as a strong, firm supporter. It has to be the supplier of certain weapon technologies that these countries don't have. And it does not have to be super frontline. Be in front of them. Let the Japanese, paradoxically, because Obama administration didn't react, absolutely didn't react, the Japanese evolved from being irresponsible and neutralist to being very serious. And, you know, if Abe goes, I'm sure it will not change. In India, I can assure you that if Rahul Gandhi, the Congress Party, takes over from Modi, there'll be no change in China policy. So, why is that? Because we have a great alliance. Who fabricated the alliance? It wasn't President Trump, although he did, you know, help a lot. It wasn't Obama. It was fabricated by Obama's failure. Because since we were not up front, they had to do it.
Yes.
And so paradoxically, Obama can claim that he achieved a great deal, which
his
is true.
His legacy was not doing enough.
Yes, because American overdoing would have inhibited that.
Right. Quick question and then a closing one. I'm not a sinologist. I learned in the White House once I came in, got the clearances, started reading things. I realized very quickly it's not ISIS, it's not Iran, it's not Russia. We'll deal with all of these. The biggest strategic level threat is China. But I'm not a sinologist. What is it that they, Xi Jinping, the Politburo, what is it that they fear the most? From me, as an amateur strategist, it's a loss of internal stability that is the most frightening to the Chinese elite. Am I on the right track?
Listen, I'm not a sinologist here, except that I've been traveling there since 1976. Right. I was there when Mao was alive. I've been going there more than once a year. I have many friends. I know, and I've been to all parts of China, remote parts. So I have the knowledge of a glorified tourist. I'm not a sinologist who can read the documents. My overwhelming sense is that so long as there is any liberalism in the world, the communist regime of China
will be afraid.
Will forever be in danger because of the fact that there is not only much more prosperity in China, much more money, there's also much more education, there's much more culture. The last time I was in a bookshop in Beijing, I was looking for translations into Chinese of Homer's Iliad. I found four of them.
Wow.
Four, all published by commercial publishers
wow.
to make money.
That's not by fascinating.
Not by some institute or other.
Yeah.
So the Chinese, the huge threat to the Communist Party is that the Chinese who travel around the world, Chinese who are becoming more and more educated.
And that's why Hong Kong matters.
Oh, terribly, because that was the open thing. Even if they're very nationalist, as many are, nationalists, the fact is that their level of culture makes it harder and harder to have this glorified corporal Xi Jinping making decisions for 1.4 billion Chinese as if they were all retarded children. These are more, the very prosperity of China that the Communist Party claims credit for, and I have some of the credit, the very prosperity means that people are not desperate to eat. They're reading, they're not just reading how-to manuals, they're reading Homer, they're reading Aristotle. Yes, there is.
How many, that's dangerous for them.
How many university departments have started up teaching the classics and philosophy?
More than here.
Correct. And they don't suppress them because they know that you cannot strangle the essence of Westernism without stopping innovation. So
we have 1 minute left. The president is a fan of the show. Whenever I see him, he asks about it. Should he be listening to this podcast? What message would you have for the 45th Commander-in-Chief right now?
To get some serious ideological analysis to show how American blacks have been exploited by the intersectional alliance, who are very, very few, very determined, and they've managed to build a coalition by and then to corral the blacks into their cause.
Wonderful. We need to understand how Francis Fukuyama was very wrong. The end of history and the last man and the death of ideology. No, Frank, it's very much alive. This has been fabulous. I hope we can repeat it. My guest has been Professor Ed Luttwak. He is on Twitter. Follow him right now. E. Luttwak, L-U-T-T-W-A-K. Start with Coup d'etat, his book, and his most recent one, The Rise of China Versus the Logic of Strategy. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.